organize their own stuff, but they can and should, but so that they can communicate as a group, as a community, because moving forward, we have safety concerns. So making sure you build community, have safe houses for these people that are having their lives threatened. But if you want to plug in with anything, the website is pdxresistance.org. There's a volunteer form. I encourage people to sign up to volunteer. We have different committees that you can select what committee you would want to be on. The donation form is there too, if you want to contribute to our GoFundMe. Our mission statement is on there, and also you can stay on there for events. There's also a high school walkout going on Monday, so anybody that can support that. The link for the GoFundMe is on our website, pdxresistance.org. I don't know the specific GoFundMe link, but on pdxresistance.org, okay, the link is there.
We got to run. We're out of time. Gregory McKelvey, Portland's Resistance, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Aftermath, part of the Brown Paper series produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs November 28th at 7 p.m. at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. In Mary Burrell's 1919 one-act, John Thornton, a young black soldier who has served his country in World War I, comes home to rural South Carolina. His homecoming is disrupted when he learns that someone close to him has been lynched by a white mob. Again, that's Aftermath, produced by Triangle Productions, November 28th at 7 p.m. at The Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Finance Committee, third Wednesday of each month at 5 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held. To request notice of board meetings in writing, please email Monica at kboo.org.
And good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. It's 9:02, and here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. First, on Political Perspectives, we'll hear a rare interview with Angela Davis from 1972, eerily reminiscent of today's political landscape. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And then at 11 o'clock, Chris Siegel is here to host the food show and will tell us how the sharing economy has come to the kitchen. Plus, how Donald Trump's presidency will affect food policy. And we here at KBOO thank you for becoming members, and thanks for your generous support, those of you who have done that. If you're not a current member, now is a great time to go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. We appreciate that, and you will too. Here comes Angela Davis.
Black bodies swinging in the sun.
Today on Political Perspectives, two presentations of the American social and political climate. One is a viewpoint from the past, and the other a more modern voice. First is Angela Davis in a rarely heard 1972 interview at Malcolm X College, presented with permission from the Chicago Film Archives. Davis discusses the upcoming presidential election, campaigning for third-party candidates, and her freedom after 16 months in prison. Listen for the striking similarities to today's electoral politics. Then, it's Ta-Nehisi Coates, author of The Case for Reparations, reading from his blockbuster memoir, Between the World and Me. Written as a series of letters to his teenage son, Coates describes his observations and the evolution of his thinking on race, from Malcolm X to his conclusion that race itself is a fabrication elemental to the concept of American exceptionalism.
We are pleased to have Sister Angela Davis, the noted scholar and freedom fighter, and Lou Palmer, a well-known Chicago journalist, and Alice Pitts, one of our journalism students, to interview Angela Davis.
Angela, I'm delighted to have this chance to chat with you for a few minutes. The first question that comes to my mind is, what brings you to Chicago?
Well, I'm in Chicago specifically to speak at a rally this evening, which has been organized in order to develop support for the candidates of the Communist Party who are running for president and vice president, Gus Hall and Jarvis Tyner. Up until the date of the elections, I'm going to be speaking at numerous rallies in various parts of the country.
Mm-hmm. In how many states is the Communist Party permitted on the ballot?
Well, as a result of massive petition campaigns and a lot of work done by members of the party, as well as the Young Workers Liberation League and others who are not in the party or the league, the party is now on the ballot in 12 states plus Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are other states where Gus and Jarvis will be on the ballot as independents, although the Communist Party as such, because of all of the anti-communism which persists in the legal structure, the party can't be on the ballot.
Why is the party, obviously, the party cannot win a victory in the presidential election. Why is it engaged in a presidential campaign in this country?
Well, we feel that the elections are extremely important. We feel that it is extremely important to bring a message to people throughout the country which will expose both Nixon and McGovern for what they are, because in the last analysis, both Nixon and McGovern, both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, are beholden to the interests of monopoly capitalism in this country. And we feel that the reason for the existence of exploitation, racism, and the war in Vietnam, the sabotage against liberation movements in Africa, all of these things are directly related to monopoly capitalism. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the campaign around the elections is a way in which we can talk to people in this country about the need to challenge fundamentally the whole system and bring about eventually a socialist revolution.
What kind of response do you get both from the people and from the press in terms of the Communist Party presidential campaign?
Well, throughout the country there's really been a massive response, because we're living in a period where people, especially black people and Chicanos and Puerto Ricans, Asians and Indians and exploited white workers are not going for all of the lies which come from the government, and not, they aren't going for the speed up and all of the ways in which the monopolies are now trying to increase their super profits on the backs of workers. And they realize that something is fundamentally wrong with not just the government, but something is fundamentally wrong with this whole system. And so as a result of this emerging consciousness, young people throughout the country are really listening to what we have to say and are really beginning to think concretely about building a socialist movement.
What about older voters?
Older people as well. I say young people because the whole new thrust in the black community, as well as within the labor movement, is coming from young people. I mean, mm-hmm. If you take the labor movement, who's challenging Meany and Fitzsimmons and all the rest of the class collaborationists who really aren't anything more than bedfellows of Nixon? I mean, they're coming from young workers who refuse to go along with
this. What about the press? I noticed a little piece about this big announcing the rally tonight, and one or two of the Chicago papers. Across the country, what kind of press do you get in this campaign?
Well, I mean, we understand where the establishment press is coming from and whose interests they serve. Of course, they aren't going to attempt to make it any easier for us. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the coverage of the party campaign isn't anything like the coverage of the Democratic or the Republican campaign. But, I mean, they're our enemies. We know which side they're on.
What about the black press?
Deal with them that way. There's been a really very good response among the black press. Gus and Jarvis have been traveling now for about 8 months.
Yeah.
And they've done a lot of interviews with the black press and other minority press.
Buddy, I don't want to monopolize the question. Why don't you get in here?
Okay, and the different factions of today's society, there are people that are saying that blacks should not participate in this upcoming election, and others are saying that our futures depend on this upcoming election. Just how do you feel that blacks should deal with this political system the way it's set up today?
Well, of course, I believe that ultimately there has to be a socialist revolution, because that's the only way in which we're going to eradicate the basis for racism and the basis for the oppression that we are suffering. In terms of this election, I think it's very important for black people to have a voice. Not very important for black people to vote for Nixon or McGovern, but it's very important for black people to be able to make it understood to whoever is elected that we want something different from what the Republicans are talking about, different from what the Democrats are talking about. I mean, because we know what Nixon's stand on racism is. We know that in the campaign, all the most racist, most reactionary, Wallace-type forces have gathered around him. And McGovern's position may be a wee bit different, but he's come out with some really racist positions. For instance, his support of Louise Hicks in Boston. I mean, she's the worst kind of racist there is. And so we have to be able to make it understood that that we want something different. We want something else. To boycott the elections is to give the impression of political apathy. And that's why I, for one, and members of my party are trying to bring the message of socialism to black people. And see, regardless of how the elections turn out, it'll make a big difference if there is a large vote for the Communist Party, if there are ways of directly expressing opposition and resistance to the established political parties and the interests that they represent, then they will not be able to continue to do all the kinds of racist things they do without a second thought, because they'll know that they have an organized force to deal with.
Angela, there are some black people, at least, who are not convinced that the American Communist Party is seriously interested in liberation of black people, that it uses black people for its own ends. What do you say to that?
Now, you talk about the Communist Party as if it's something separate and apart for black people. There are a lot of black people in the party. The chairman of the Communist Party is a black man who spent years of his life in prison and is blind at this point because of the grossly inadequate medical treatment he received in prison. I think that if you would seriously study both the policy of the Communist Party with respect to black liberation and the history of the party in terms of its activities within the black liberation struggle, that it wouldn't be possible to make that kind of statement that you're making.
Do you think it's possible that the American Communist Party has not carried on a sufficiently adequate public relations job to the masses of black people, or has the American capitalistic system carried on a extremely effective job on our minds?
Well, I mean, we know who controls the media. We know who controls all of the instruments of propaganda in this country at this point. I mean, we haven't developed sufficiently to the point where we are a massive political force, and I'm not talking about just the party, I'm talking about all progressive forces, black people, Chicanos, and, you know, all progressive forces in this country. And we have to understand that they are going to do anything that they can, first of all, to break any kind of unity between progressive forces, because the more we are disunified, the easier it is for them to continue to exploit and repress us. Mm-hmm. One of the very subtle ways of trying to disrupt the movement and to make people think in anti-communist concepts is, the kind of thing that the established media engage in. And they aren't doing it because they're any more interested in black liberation or any more interested in anything else. I mean, and for us to fall prey to that type of thing really points to an inability to understand the ways in which the enemy functions. Mm-hmm.
You may have answered this question already, but let me put it anyhow. There are also some people, at least in Chicago, who have raised the question whether you, as an individual, after having won your acquittal, whether you are more concerned with the building of the Communist Party than you are with the struggle of oppressed peoples, the black masses. Can you respond to that? I hear this quite often. In fact, one woman sent me a letter indicating that this was one reason why she was resigning from the Chicago Angela Davis Defense Committee. What's your response to that?
Well, I think it was very clear from the very beginning of the case that I was a communist,
right,
because I feel that this is the only way in which we are going to ultimately liberate ourselves as black people. I would not be in the Communist Party if I felt that the interests of the party were in any way opposite to the interests of black liberation. Mm-hmm. And certainly, I don't know anything about the case you just mentioned, but my experiences since the acquittal have pointed to precisely the opposite kind of reaction among black people. I mean, not too long after the trial was over, I spoke in Detroit, and it was a really interesting rally. About 10,000 people were present. A lot of them couldn't get in, and we had not expected that kind of massive turnout. And then also, having been in jail for the last couple of years and having been isolated to a certain degree from what was happening on the outside, I was sort of searching for the kinds of things that to say, you know, that people would react to. And I hadn't necessarily planned to talk about communism or socialism, but as soon as I mentioned one thing about the need to challenge the whole monopoly capitalist system and to talk about socialism, there was an incredibly fantastic response, a roaring applause. Mm-hmm. And these were black workers who were there in Detroit. There are a lot of black auto workers, and the whole stadium was filled with black auto workers primarily.
What you're saying, I take it then, is that it is simply impossible to separate the activities of the Communist Party from the activities of the black liberation movement. Is that what you're saying?
Well, certainly. I mean, otherwise, if as I said before, if I felt that the interests of the party and black people conflicted in any way, I wouldn't be a member of it, because I'm mm-hmm. interested first and foremost in the liberation of my people. And I feel that the policy of the party, as well as the practice, has been the only consistently correct approach to black liberation. See, I don't think that we can talk about black liberation without overturning the system, overturning the root cause for the oppression of black people. The only way we can do that, I feel, is through a socialist revolution. And that's going to involve not only black people, but all oppressed people in this society.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Davis, it has been said that if the blacks were in this revolution to go communist, the same thing would happen to them, which is now supposed to be happening allegedly to the Jews of Russia, and that they would be treated about the same way. How do you feel about
what's
this?
What's happening with the Jews in the Soviet too?
From what we've heard, the Jews have been greatly oppressed. And
heard from where?
From the media, which we...
And we also hear from the media that black people really are not oppressed, and black people have made incredible advances over the last years. I mean, you have to first of all ask yourself who is reporting this situation. And of course, it's the media, which is controlled by the ruling class in this country. And then you have to ask yourself, what are their motives? And obviously, first and foremost, the monopoly capitalist interests in this country are interested in preventing any kind of progressive political ideas and organizations from emerging, which would challenge their power. Now, I mean, take the Soviet Union. There are Jews, some Jews are leaving the Soviet Union to go to Israel because they have been made to believe that the situation in Israel is better for them as Jews. I mean, a lot of Jews, I think, have been deceived by Zionist ideas. When I was in the Soviet Union not very long ago, I saw quite a few letters that were written by Jews who had left the Soviet Union, had gone to Israel, and had seen what capitalism was like, and had seen the oppression and the exploitation that Jews in Israel also experienced, as well as Arabs. And they were writing to ask to come back. Now, you talk about socialism and the present effect of socialism on people of color. You look at the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union has large areas populated primarily by Asians, by people of color. I visited, while I was there, the Central Asian Republic of Uzbekistan. And I was far more impressed by what I saw than I had expected to be. Because there was a situation in Uzbekistan and Central Asia where prior to the socialist revolution in 1917, they were living under the worst kind of feudal oppression and repression imaginable. The women in Uzbekistan, because the traditional religion was the religion of Islam. The women, like in many other Arab countries, other Islamic countries, wore long robes and horsehair veils. They weren't allowed to show their face to any other man except their husband. And if their husband suspected that another man had seen their face, that was reason enough for him to kill her with impunity. I mean, that's the kind of situation which existed there. And now you see women in Uzbekistan participating fully in political, economic, social life, high positions in the party and the government. The chairwoman of the House of Nationalities, which is one of the two bodies of the Supreme Soviet in the Soviet Union, is a Central Asian woman from Uzbekistan. Just a couple of more words about the relationship of socialism to people of color. We were in Cuba, and in Cuba, of course, there are vast numbers of black and brown people. And if you compare the situation before the revolution in 1959, when there was the worst kind of racism promoted, encouraged, perpetrated by U.S. imperialists, to the situation now, there isn't any point of comparison at all. I think that if you ever went, visited the Soviet Union or Cuba, any other place where there are people of color in socialist countries today, you'd have a totally different perspective on it, and totally different notion of what socialism is all about. But see, they don't want black people to learn about socialism. The imperialists don't, because in the world today, who is growing stronger? Socialism, the national liberation forces, and anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist movements in capitalist countries. Who's growing weaker? Imperialism is growing weaker. Look at the situation in Vietnam. And they don't want us to relate to this worldwide movement, because they feel that we might become a little bit more confident about our ability to win, and we might be a little bit bolder, and we might start doing more things that would challenge the power of the monopolies here. But things are going to change, because there are more and more black people, more and more people of color in this country today who are thinking very seriously about socialism, about Marxist-Leninism, and fundamental revolutionary transformation of the whole society.
Could I just shift the focus of discussion for a moment and talk about you? How are you? People are concerned. How do you feel? How are you after this ordeal you went through? You doing okay?
I'm here.
You know that.
I'm healthy, I think.
Good. What are your plans? I imagine the next couple of weeks are going to be pretty tied down. Some talk about going back to your old job. Have you come to any conclusion about what you're going to do?
Well, yeah, I've pretty much decided to... There was no question about what I was going to do in general. I mean, I was going to be active in the movement for liberation.
Right.
What we're trying to do now is to build an organization, a national organization, around the demands to free political prisoners, and also in order to launch a more consistent, systematic attack against the prisons in this country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I assume, about all of the various committees that developed and emerged around my case when I was in prison. And, of course, when the acquittal came, we felt that it was very important to try to keep this structure and keep the people in order to continue to demand the freedom of other political prisoners. So primarily what I'm going to be doing over the next year is working on building this organization. Now, this organization it's going to be a very broad kind of organization in terms of including people of all various political orientations. And we learned a lot of lessons from the mass movement that developed around my case. And we have to use those lessons in order to build further movements and bring more people into a political struggle. One of the most important things that we learned was that when you talk about building a movement around a political prisoner, around political prisoners in general, or something that affects large numbers of people, you have to avoid all forms of sectarianism. You can't say that in order to defend me, for instance, that it was necessary for those who got involved in the movement to also agree with my politics, to also agree with communism. And the reason why it's so important to build those kinds of movements is that repression today does not really discriminate systematically. There are political prisoners who are on all points in the whole spectrum of radical thought and radical political activity. And we feel that it's very important to create a movement which will not be which will not emerge as most movements around political prisoners emerge, namely spontaneously in the midst of a crisis situation, which means that you have to start from scratch every time there's a major case involving a political prisoner, building a whole movement up in order to deal with him or her. You have to create a sustained organization that has the ability to take on whatever cases emerge as they emerge without having to do all the groundwork all over again. Because what usually happens is that you have a movement, and then right after, if there's an acquittal, then the movement collapses, right, because there's nothing else to do. And we feel that a movement around political prisoners is extremely important today as a part of an anti-imperialist movement, too, because as I was saying before, the most important thing I feel is to create an anti-imperialist consciousness. That's one of the things that I became much more aware of during the trip. You know, it's sometimes when you're in a situation all the time, you lack overall view, and you become sort of provincial and becoming all caught up in problems and becoming frustrated when you experience a setback. But when you look at it from the point of view of a world struggle, and you know that there are people all over in the socialist countries, our sisters and brothers in Africa are struggling, in Latin America, and when you see our struggles as being intimately intertwined with their struggles. Therefore, if they win a victory, if the Vietnamese win a victory, that's a victory for us. Mm-hmm. And they see us also as carrying out their struggle here within the very heartland of imperialism. And I became aware of the fact that we as black people, as other people of color, as people with progressive ideologies, communists, radicals, have a very special responsibility to people all over the world, because the U.S. government and the monopolies it represents, they are carrying the banner of imperialist exploitation and oppression all over the world.
Can you see a growing awareness among particularly black people here in this country in terms of the need to recognize the international aspects of our own struggle?
Yeah, because there's some very real reasons why that's the case. I mean, take the development now of multinational corporations and what's happening is that as it becomes more profitable for them to move whole plants to other countries abroad, to Taiwan, to other places where cheap labor can be, then they just dismantle a whole operation here, leaving primarily blacks unemployed, leaving them in a situation where they have absolutely no economic security. And I think that, like, that's one very real reason why internationalism is important. That's another reason why I think there is a growing consciousness of the international character of our movement. I mean, we were just in Cuba and Chile. You know, you hear about Guantanamo Base, but to be there and see that the United States military actually illegitimately occupies a part of Cuban territory. Mm. And while we were there, they took us to a point where we could look through some powerful binoculars and actually see what was going on. It was really a strange sensation to be standing in socialism with our feet on socialist territory and seeing U.S. cars and you know, people and planes and all the things that they have are just a few hundred yards away. I think that more and more countries that are subject to imperialist attacks are looking towards us as being their major allies because of the strategic position we have
us
right
being,
here.
When you say us.
Their allies.
Yeah.
I mean us meaning, well, see, while we were in the socialist countries. We talked about the other United States of America, which includes black people, Chicanos, Puerto Ricans, all people of color, students, workers, and all those whose interests are opposed to the interests of imperialism and monopolies here.
When you say us, you don't mean you period, S period. You mean U.S., us. You don't...
I mean us, yeah. All of us.
All right. We together.
And we talked about the other United States of America. I was just going to point out that one of the very surprising things that happened on the tour was that the Cubans presented me with their highest state decoration, which is called the Playa Girón Award, the Bay of Pigs. It's an award commemorating the Bay of Pigs invasion. And the significance of that was that they weren't giving it to me as an individual, obviously. They were giving it to all progressive people in this country through me, black people, and all of the other progressive forces here. And it was an indication of the important role they see us as playing in the struggle, the global struggle against imperialism. I think we have a very deep responsibility to live up to that.
To go back to the political thing, and more basically to one person in particular, President Nixon. He has stated he is anti-communist, but in the last 2 years, he's traveled to Peking, Russia, and he's had these talks, and now he's thinking about ending the war, and so far from the way the media has covered it, to drop his friendship, shall we say, with the premier of South Vietnam, or the president of South Vietnam.
Well,
just what do you feel?
Well, see, look,
is this, you know?
We talked about imperialism declining in power. The fact that Nixon went to Peking and went to Moscow indicates that imperialism is now on the defensive. They have to deal with socialism. They have to deal with the national.
Angela, I'm so sorry. We've got to signal that the time is up. And I hate to interrupt you. Maybe we can carry on after we get off camera. Thank you so much.
You're listening to 90.7 KBOO Portland. That was Angela Davis speaking in 1972 at Malcolm X College. The speech was unearthed by the Chicago Film Archives. Now we turn to writer, journalist, and educator Ta-Nehisi Coates, reading from his highly acclaimed work, Between the World and Me.
The first is the opening section where, you know, I pretty much lay out the mission of the book, and it's all about fear and what it means to grow up under fear. This is from my book, Between the World and Me. Very excited to read this here. Last Sunday, the host of a popular news show asked me what it meant to lose my body. I was appearing on a well-regarded news program. I was seated in a studio on the far west side of Manhattan. There was a cord coming out of my ear and another dangling from my shirt. Someone had applied makeup to my face. I saw the screen cut away from the host and words which I had written that week scroll by. The host read these words for the audience, and when she finished, she turned to the loss of my body. She did not mention my body specifically, but by now I am accustomed to intelligent people asking about the condition of my body without realizing the nature of their request. Specifically, the host wished to know why I felt, as I had recently claimed, that white America's progress was built on looting and violence. Hearing this, an old and indistinct sadness welled up in me. The answer to this question, as you have likely gleaned by now, is the record of white America itself. There is nothing extreme in this statement. Americans are believers in what the historian Barbara Fields has helpfully dubbed racecraft. That is to say, they believe race to be the creation of physical law, and thus cousin to gravity, inertia, or the curvature of the earth. American racism is thus considered a natural byproduct and an unfortunate side effect of an unalterable condition. In this way, a great crime is covered in the innocence of science. But race flows from racism, not the other way around, and white America has never been so much a matter of genealogy and physiognomy as hierarchy. Differences in hue and hair are old, but the belief in the preeminence of hue and hair, the notion that these factors can correctly organize a society, that they grant deeper attributes which are indelible, this is the new idea at the heart of these new people who have been brought up hopelessly, tragically, deceitfully, to believe that they are white. These new people have not spread their new belief nor achieved their new prominence through wine tastings and ice cream socials, but through the pillaging of life, liberty, labor, and land, through the flaying of backs, the chaining of limbs, the strangling of dissidents, the destruction of families, the rape of mothers, the sale of children, and various other acts meant first and foremost to deny you and I the right to secure and govern our own bodies. The new people are not original in this. Perhaps there is a great power whose elevation is exempt from the violent exploitation of other human bodies. If there is, I have yet to encounter it. But this banality of violence can never excuse America because America makes no claims to the banal. Indeed, we believe ourselves to be uniquely called to the work of democracy and thus large among all nations across time and space. We would do well to take this claim seriously. And this is difficult because all around us there is an entire apparatus urging us to accept our world as face value and not inquire too much. And it is too easy to look away, to think mainly of Pop-Tarts and Frosted Flakes, to obsess over Blu-rays and ski trips, to live among the magnificent telephones and wondrous applications, and in so doing, ignore the great evil done in all of our name. But you and I have never had that luxury. I think you know. I write you in your 14th year. I write you because you saw Eric Garner choked to death for selling cigarettes, and you know that Renisha McBride was shot for seeking help, that John Crawford was shot down for browsing in a department store. And you have seen men drive by and murder Tamir Rice, an 11-year-old child whom they were oath-bound to protect. And you have seen these same men pummel someone's grandma on the side of a thoroughfare in California. And you must know that the police departments of your country have been endowed with the power to destroy your body. It does not matter if the destruction of your body was an unfortunate overreaction. It does not matter that the destruction of your body originates in a misunderstanding. It does not matter if the destruction of your body springs from foolish policy. Sell cigarettes without the proper authority and your body can be destroyed. Resent the people trying to entrap your body and it can be destroyed. Turn into a dark stairwell and your body can be destroyed. The destroyers of your body will rarely be held accountable. Mostly they will receive pensions. And destruction is merely the superlative dominion, whose prerogatives include friskings, detainings, beatings, and humiliations. All of this is common to black people. All of this is old for black people. No one is held responsible. The body of Michael Brown was left in the middle of the street for 4 hours. It cannot be expected that anyone will be held responsible. And there is nothing uniquely evil in the destroyers of your body, for they are merely men enforcing the whims of your country and correctly interpreting its heritage and legacy. This legacy aims toward the shackling of your body. It is hard to face this, but all of our phrasing, race relations, racial chasm, racial justice, racial profiling, white privilege, even white supremacy, obscure the fact that racism is a visceral experience, that it dislodges brains, blocks airways, rips anuses, knocks out teeth, extracts testicles, disembowels. Last Sunday, I tried to explain this as best I could within the time allotted. But at the end of the segment, the host flashed a much-dispensed picture of an 11-year-old black boy tearfully clutching the midriff of a white police officer and then asked about hope. And I knew then that I had failed. And I remembered that I had, in fact, expected to fail. And I wondered at the indistinct sadness welling in me. Why was I sad? I came out of that studio and walked for a while. It was a calm December day. Families believing themselves white were out on the street. Infants raised to be white were bundled in strollers. And I was sad for these people, much as I was sad for the host and sad for all the people out there watching and reveling in an unearned hope. I realized then why I was sad. When the journalist asked me about my body, it was like she was asking me to awaken her from the most gorgeous dream. I have seen that dream all my life. It is modest houses with nice lawns. It is Memorial Day cookouts, block associations, and driveways. The dream is treehouses and Cub Scouts. The dream smells like peppermint but tastes like strawberry shortcake. And I have wanted so long to escape into that dream, to fold my country over my head like a blanket, until all the bad things are vanquished by magic. But this has never been an option, because the fact is the dream is built on us, because the bedding was made from our bodies. And knowing this, and knowing that the dream is a dream, is an escape, and is not the actual world, I was sad for the host. I was sad for all of these families. I was sad for my country. But above all, I was sad for you. That was the week you learned that the killer of Michael Brown, that the men who left his body in the street like some awesome declaration of their inviolable power, would go unpunished. I had known that these men would go unpunished from the moment I heard Michael Brown's name. But you were young and still believed. And the dream is so lovely. You stayed up waiting for the announcement of an indictment. And when there was none, you said, I've got to go. And you went into your room and I heard you crying. I came in 5 minutes after and I did not hug you and I did not comfort you because I thought it would be wrong to comfort you. I did not tell you it would be okay because I have never believed it would be okay. What I told you is what your grandparents endeavored to tell me. I told you that this was your country, that this was your world, that this is your body, and you must find some way to live within this world and within that body. I tell you this is the question. I tell you this is the question of how one should live within a black body, and it is the question of my life, and the pursuit of this question I have found ultimately answers the question itself. This must seem strange to you. We live in a goals-oriented era. Our published vocabulary are full of hot takes, big ideas, actionable solutions, and grand theories of everything. But some time ago, I rejected magic in all its forms, and I accepted that I would die. This was not a retreat into cynicism. When I say that I accepted I would die, I mean that I was freed from any consideration of second lives and preordained justice. And in accepting the fact of my total end, I was free to truly consider how I wish to live. When I look back, I see that I have always been asking a profound version of this question, perhaps the most profound version. How do I live free in this body? It is profound because America fashions itself as the work of the divine, and the black body is the clearest evidence that it is the work of men. I have asked this question through my readings and my writings, through the music of my youth, through arguments with your grandfather, with your mother, with your Aunt Janae, with your Uncle Ben. I was asking it when I thought about you and the reasons I wanted you to be. The question is unanswerable, which is not to say futile. The greatest reward of this constant interrogation, of confrontation with the brutality of my country, is that it has freed me from the ghosts and the myths and girded me against the sheer terror of disembodiment. And I am very afraid. I feel this fear most acutely whenever you leave me, but I was afraid long before you, and in this I was unoriginal. When I was your age, the only people I knew were black, and all of them were powerfully, adamantly, dangerously afraid. I had seen this fear evidenced all my young life, though I had not always recognized it as such. I had seen it in the extravagant boys of my neighborhood, in their large rings and medallions, in their big, puffy coats, and full-length fur-collared leathers, which was their armor against the world. It was always right in front of me. They would stand on the corner of Gwin Oak and Liberty or Cold Spring and Park Heights or outside of Mondawmin Mall with their hands dipped in their Russell sweats. I think back on these boys now and all I see is fear, and all I see is them girding themselves against the ghosts of the bad old days when the Mississippi mobs gathered around their grandfathers so that the branches of the black body might be torched and cut away. The fear lived on in their practice bop, in their slouching denim, in their big t-shirts, in the calculated angle of their baseball caps, a whole catalog of behaviors and garments enlisted to inspire the belief that these boys were in firm possession of everything they desired. I saw it in all their rituals of war. I was no older than 5, sitting out on my porch on Woodbrook Avenue, watching 2 shirtless boys circle each other close and buck shoulders. From then on, I knew that there was a ritual to a street fight. Bylaws and codes which in their very need attested to all the vulnerability of black teenage bodies. I heard the fear in the first music I ever knew, the music that pumped from boom boxes full of carnal boasts and messianic destiny, The boys who stood out on Garrison and Liberty up on Park Heights loved this music because it told them, against all evidence and odds, that they truly were masters of all they surveyed. I saw it in the girls, in their loud laughter, in their gilded bamboo earrings, which announced their names three times over. And I saw it in their brutal language and hard gaze, how they would cut you with their eyes, destroy you with their words, all for the sin of playing too much. Keep my name out your mouth, they would say. I would watch them after school, how they squared off like boxers, Vaseline'd up, earrings off, Reeboks on, and leapt at each other. I felt the fear in my visits to my Nana's home in Philadelphia. You never knew her. I barely knew her myself. But what I remember is her hard manner, her rough voice. And I remember her man and his odd name, Grandpa Wally, which nodded to the void where your great-grandfather should have been. But I knew that my father's father was dead, and that my Uncle Oscar was dead, and that my Uncle David was dead, and that each of these instances were unnatural. And I saw it in my own father, who loves you, who counsels you, who slipped me money to care for you when your mother and I had no idea. Dad was so very afraid. I felt it in the sting of his black leather belt, which he applied with more anxiety than anger. My father, who beat me like someone might steal me away, because that is exactly what was happening all around us. Everyone had a lost child, somehow, to the streets. It was said that these lost girls were sweet as honey and would not hurt a fly. It was said that these lost boys had just received a GED and had begun to turn their lives around. Now they were gone, and their legacy was a great fear. Perhaps you already know. Perhaps it has already come to you. It came to me when I was somewhat younger, most outrageously. I was 11 years old, standing out in the parking lot in front of a 7-Eleven, watching a crew of older boys standing near the streets. They yelled and gestured at who? Another boy, young like me, who stood there almost smiling, gamely throwing up his hands. The boy had lost his body a long time ago, and he knew it. Who knows what brought him to knowledge, the projects, a drunken stepfather, an older brother concussed by the police, a cousin pinned in the city jail. That he was outnumbered did not matter because the whole galaxy had outnumbered him long ago. And this was a war for the possession of his body, and that would be the war of his entire life. I stood there for some seconds, marveling at the older boy's beautiful sense of fashion. They all wore ski jackets, the kind which, in my day, mothers put on layaway in September, then piled up overtime hours so as to have the thing wrapped and ready for Christmas. I focused in on a light-skinned boy with a long head and small eyes, scowling at this other boy who stood close to me. It was just before 3 p.m. I was in the 6th grade. School had just let out, and it was not yet the fighting weather of early spring. What was the exact problem here? Who could know? The boy with the small eyes reached into his ski jacket and pulled out. I recall it in the slowest motion, as though tumbling from a skyscraper into a dream. There the boy stood with the gun brandished, which he slowly untucked, tucked, and untucked once more, and in his small eyes I saw a surging rage that could, in an instant, erase my body. That was 1986. That was the year I felt myself to be drowning in the news reports of murder, and I was aware that these murders very often did not land upon intended targets, but fell upon great aunts, PTA mothers, overtime uncles, and joyful children, fell upon them random and relentless, like great sheets of rain. I knew this in theory, but I could not understand it as fact until the boy with the small eyes stood across from me, holding my entire body in his small hand. The boy with the small eyes did not shoot. His friends pulled him back. He did not need to shoot. He had affirmed our place in the order of things. He had let it be known how easily we could be selected. I took the subway home that day, processing the episode all along. I did not tell my parents. I did not tell my teachers. And if I told my friends, I would have done so with all the excitement needed to obscure the fear that came over me in that moment. That was the era when I first began to comprehend the captive power of my country. I remember being amazed that death could easily rise up from the nothing of a boyish afternoon and billow up the way like a fog. I knew that West Baltimore, where I lived, that Philadelphia, where my cousins live, that Chicago, where the friends of my father lived, comprised a world apart from all others. And too, I knew that somewhere out there, beyond the firmament, past the asteroid belt, there were other worlds where children did not regularly fear for their bodies. I knew this because there was a large television set resting in my living room. In the evening, I sat before this television set, bearing witness to the dispatches from the dream. In the dream, there were little boys with complete collections of football cards, and their only wants were popular girls, and their only worry was poison oak. The dream was suburban and endless, was organized around pot roast, blueberry pie, fireworks, ice cream sundaes, immaculate bathrooms, and small toy trucks that were loosed in wooded backyards with streams and glens. Comparing these dispatches with the facts of my native world, I came to understand that my country was a galaxy. And this galaxy stretched from the pandemonium of the West Baltimore of my youth to the happy hunting grounds of Mr. Belvedere. I obsessed over the distance between that other sector of space and my own. I knew that my portion of the American galaxy where bodies were enslaved by a tenacious gravity was black and that the other liberated portion was not. I knew that some inscrutable energy preserved the breach. I felt, but did not yet understand, the relation between the other world and me. And I felt in this cosmic injustice a profound cruelty which infused an abiding, irrepressible desire to unshackle my body and achieve a velocity of escape. So I am... There's a lot that happens. I mean, it's roughly a story. I wrote this memoir, and the memoir ended like in college, and rather unintentionally, it's kind of ended up as like a sequel. Although I think this is a little bit more argumentative and less memoiristic. So it starts there, and basically like where the memoir leaves off in West Baltimore, and then it picks up, and you know, I go to college, and when I was in college, there was a young man. And this is like the hard thing about like the Michael Brown thing, and you know, this whole summer, which you know, these whole past few years, which I'm not completely sure there's an increase, you know, in these kinds of killings as much as there's just so much more awareness. Everybody has iPhones and cameras, and people can record stuff, upload it, and you know, it's just sort of out there in a particular way. But my son, you know, he was coming to this awareness, and probably the first time I came to it in a really, really literal way. Was in college. I had a friend named Prince Jones, and Prince was from a very, very good family, very upwardly mobile African-American family. And shortly after I graduated, after my son was born, he was driving from just a meeting, hanging out with some friends, through Washington, D.C., out into Virginia, which is just south of Washington, D.C., and he was shot there. By a police officer who was from Prince George's County, where he had started his journey. And the cop had followed him under the suspicion that he was a criminal. Prince was like the furthest thing from a criminal. And when they went back to investigate it, they tried to find any sort of way by which he might be a criminal that would explain how this guy would be killed. They didn't really investigate the officer. They investigated my friend. And what they came up with was a born-again Christian whose mom was a radiologist, raised in Opelousas, Louisiana, and had come from dirt poverty and raised herself all the way up, you know, to be this really, really prominent, you know, woman who had sent this kid off to Howard University. And the killer part about it was the mistake was made because he was driving a Jeep, and the Jeep was the same make as the guy who they, you know, had this lead on, they thought was a criminal. The only thing these two people shared was that they just happened to be black males. The guy they were looking for was short and a little overweight. Prince was like, you know, 6'4", and maybe like 180 pounds, not overweight at all. He just happened to be black. And when they ran the license tags on Prince, they got his mother's address, because his mother had bought him this Jeep. And I went to talk to this woman about a year ago, you know, just to, you know, hear her story, and it really brought all of this home. And she said, you know, I bought him that Jeep, and that was the Jeep he was killed in. And this, you know, had just a huge, huge impact on me. I actually, you know, in many ways, you know, it's one of the, you know, sort of primary events that shifted, you know, my sense of American history. So, like, to be there with my son and I have to replay this constantly, you know, in these conversations is difficult, as you can imagine. As I was saying, we came here in 2013, and you know, balanced against, you know, this whole notion that I'm trying to establish early in the book of gravity, of your body being captive to history, to society, in a way that you didn't quite create, is this notion of attempting to get out. Is there any actual way to get out? You know, can we get our kids out? You know, can I get out, frankly?
That was Ta-Nehisi Coates reading from Between the World and Me. Before that was Angela Davis at Malcolm X College, presented with permission from the Chicago Film Archives. This has been Political Perspectives on 90.7 KBOO Portland.
You're tuned to KBOO Portland. The time is 9:59. And coming up at 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock, Chris Siegel hosts The Food Show and will tell us how the sharing economy has come to the kitchen. Also, how Donald Trump's presidency will affect food policy. But coming right up is Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And today, you'll want to be tuning in because we have a interview directly from Standing Rock in North Dakota, and we look forward to hearing about that after a couple of announcements. Thanks for tuning in to KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to sponsor the Elysian Brewing Breakbeat IPA KBOO benefit on December 8th at the Liquor Store Bar and Venue in Portland. KBOO and Elysian Brewing will celebrate the release of the Manic IPA series with hip-hop, funk, and electronica spun by The Pariahs, DJ Dakimba, and Vinology. Again, that's Elysian Brewing Breakbeat IPA KBOO benefit on December 8th at the Liquor Store Bar and Venue, 3341 Southeast Belmont Avenue in Portland.